you've got to sort of have that feeling of genuine sadness and genuine loss to generate some new energy. Think, well, we can't have that. We can't lose it all, you know. But yeah. You can't not have the. You can't just go and live in a, like you said, go and live in a boffy and burn peat.
Why
and
not?
Eat turnips. You've got to sort of live in this world. Well, you might want to, but you can't. You know, not now. We've got to deal with this. You know, kids coming around and banging on your door and wanting sweets.
Yeah.
When there's more to it.
Yeah.
But that more to it will come as we engage.
The trouble with it is it's a bit like Father Christmas, isn't it? We're encouraged to leave it until we're seven, and then we're told it's all a big fairy story and it's time to grow up now.
That's very interesting what you said there, Phil, because this, I mean, we are born with this sense of loss, this sense of being dispossessed, this, all that sort of thing, and maybe we need that because of our, to give us the impetus to move forward, because people in the 17th century were saying exactly the same thing about Punky Night, when people were going and kicking out over their outhouses because they wouldn't give them a turnip or a penny.
Yeah.
It's, you know,
yeah.
It's all the same thing, isn't it?
It's grist.
Every generation harks back to a slightly more golden age.
Mm. Yeah, that's right. Mm.
But now we're blessed with this modern, for all its awful stuff, we're blessed with, as you say, knowledge of quantum mechanics and, you know, the infinite universe and...
So is the way of getting back, I'm really interested in this because it's all about generic folk stuff at the moment, and I wondered if one way of getting engagement, getting back to it, is being more specific about it, because one thing I don't see is people being specific to their area. I mean, I wonder how many mentions there have been of Gwyn ap Nudd, for example, in Glastonbury over Samhain, you know, whose festival it is at the moment, you know, who's meant to ride out from the tour, that's what, and it seems to be a study of the specifics of your land, what people believed in your land, not in the Highlands and Islands, but I don't know whether, how much of that is a retreat into the past and how much is actually really useful because the land and the myths still speak to us.
Oh, that's so complicated, Ben, because the... I mean, Glastonbury is a particular case anyway, but... So many of the myths that we think of as local are not local at all.
Mm.
And the Gwyn ap Nudd myth is very modern.
But it goes back to early medieval times, doesn't it?
No.
Don't you think? What do you think?
Gwyn living in the Tor, I thought that was. Back to Colin.
Well, you get Cochlan and the encounters of the King of the Fairies.
Oh, that's right. He's never named it.
He's not named as Gwyn.
Oh, yes.
He's not named as he's not named as Gwyn ap Nudd in the middle in these kinds of in these medieval traditions. He gets named as that later.
Right.
And then you get a whole modern retelling of that story as him being Gwyn ap Nudd and Arthur arbitrating between Gwyn ap Nudd and Gwythyr for the love of Coedlydd on May Eve normally, really, and then people have extrapolated that into Samhain as being the other point of the year.
But that's
come about because of the development of the eightfold cycles of the year, which didn't exist. The eightfold festivals didn't exist until the development of Wicca. Now the different festivals existed. And they were, kind of celebrated in different times and different places by different groups of people. But this innovation, it's a nice innovation. I have no problem, we'll quarrel with it. But it isn't, the Eightfold Festivals have happened within our lifetime.
No,
or maybe slightly before that.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking of stuff that was written down in Glastonbury Abbey about, I think Gwyn ap Nudd's father, the first people living at Compton Dundas, Brentnall. I honestly can't remember, but I think the name is certainly more ancient than this century.
Well, the name is Gwyn Ap Nudd. Yeah, yes, we find Gwyn Ap Nudd.
Association, but I don't know. I'm going to say
yeah, I think we're danger of going down a bit of a tangent. But I guess what I'm saying is really that the engagement with these old stories is important, so that we breathe life into these old stories, and they create, just in a way that Fiona McLeod did, they create something new and generative, that matches the particular conditions of our time.
And that's a personal thing or a community thing?
Well, it becomes both, doesn't it? It obviously starts off always as a personal thing. So as we, if you're drawn to a particular story or a particular myth or a particular figure in a myth. So if we think of, Merlin, let's just think of Merlin for a moment. Anybody ever have a resonance with Merlin? Has Merlin been a figure in your inner world?
Everyone should be.
Great. Right, quite a few of us, right? So, what is it that's attractive about Merlin?
The sarcastic one in Excalibur. That's attractive, man.
Yes.
There's two elements, isn't there? There's that grand ancientness feeling of Merlin, but then there's a feeling that he's mythic, he's still here, he's constant.
Yeah.
It's
fluid, because there's the wise, everyone agrees, and there's the crazy man, isn't there? So he's mysterious.
Yeah.
Mysterious. Yeah. He's mystery,
magic, really. Magic.
Yeah, that's right.
And the passing of an old way as well.
That's right. And the recreation of ways, right? So there's that, and so we, you know, even if you look at the T.H. White's Merlin, for example, which is a kind of funny, humorous, but also powerfully magical, who teaches Arthur about shape-shifting into bird and beast and contemplating the life of nature, and who enables Arthur to become the king. And then and then when we go back through the centuries with Merlin, we find the repetition of stories. So stories change massively in detail, but there are these fundamental kind of motifs that remain the same. So Merlin is connected always with a wisdom that's about the connection to nature, connection to the energies of transformation, the bringing through of something new, the enabling of a sense of a centre and a sense of sovereignty to emerge. And he is at the service of this goddess figure, which gets clearer the further back you go, you know. And when you trace even the etymology of Merlin, you come back to Maridunum, and you discover he is the man of the sea. And as the man of the sea is connected to the changing rhythms of the sea and the moon, and he appears and disappears. So he's got quite a profound connection. He's not the Sun King, who is Arthur. He's got a profound connection to the forest and the moon and the Lord of the Forest.
Another, I don't know if it's where it comes from, really, or if it's just a lucky coincidence, but the whole idea of the mer line as well, you know, like the mer, the mermaids.
Yes, exactly.
The line of the mer. So he's also like... connected to the sea in that way.
Completely, exactly that, right? So you can just see this fluid, shape-shifting kind of figure who is elusive but powerful, you know, when we look at the Arthurian legends, he turns up in all kinds of different guises and is unrecognizable to people often, but he's this catalyzing kind of influence, really, and he appears in all kinds of odd places. And Lawrence Durrell's novels, Tankan Nukwam, he turns up as a figure in a bank in a banking house that in a corrupt banking house that kind of reveals all the corruptions and sort of and difficulties. In C.S. Lewis's Hideous Strength, he represents this energy of nature that is challenging the disturbed, satanic, technological energies of that are trying to enslave people at that time. So you see the way these kind of archetypal figures repeat themselves, and we are drawn specifically, I think, sometimes when we think of specificity. It can, of course, sometimes be about locality, but I think almost certainly we're drawn by specificity within our own soul, where we are attracted to particular archetypal forms that speak to us and speak to us about our function in the world. And the one of the kind of really interesting things about the kind of being a human being is a human being, in a sense, is as opposed to an elf or a god or an animal, human being above all has the capacity, or should have the capacity, to stand in the midst of the circle and integrate all the elements of life. So the sense of being a human being is to be a sort of a composite being that brings things together and can work with difference and work with opposites in such a way to generate new possibilities. Now, when we go into regress, regression things, and people do all the time, that sense of the hatred of the stranger, which is such a big thing in our time, is an old tribal idea. The strange person will come, will take our partners, will take our money, will take our houses, will strip away, and so we have to gather together around our tribal symbols. So right at the moment, you know, we get the eruption of the George Cross and incidentally, there's a wonderful, I don't know if people know this, there's a wonderful hoax happened somewhere that I can't help laugh about. Somebody sent a very official looking letter to people who had put George Crosses up outside their properties, informing people that they have been chosen because they are aware that these are true patriots, that anyone showing the George Cross is a true patriot in this country. So therefore they understand that they really want to help the government at this time of crisis. And so they have been chosen to guest an immigrant who would have been put up in a hotel. And they're very fortunate because they've chosen people from the Fra Rajay tribe, who are currently homeless, and it's caused a bit of a furore. But some genius decided to write them. But that energy that we see in the world at the moment, where is a regression to a tribal state of consciousness. See it in America when Trump is going on a bloody Manifest Destiny, which is a sort of a 19th, early 20th century American phrase for world domination by white Americans. You know, you see these old ideas, these old images returning. And that is always the danger of this kind of upsurge of these ancient images from the past. Instead of us meeting them and incorporating them within the power of the human heart and within the capacity to generate them in new ways, that we get sucked back into old ways, into sort of the and one of the kind of curious elements, I think, about if you like, the modern tradition as it stands at the moment, is as we become conscious of nature again, as we become conscious of ancestry, as we become conscious of ancestors and working with them, the shadow side of that has really is fully with us, because we're with the whole if you look at the whole thing that happened around Nazi Germany, which is about blood and land, soil and blood. You know, the supremacy of, and above all, the supremacy of the Volk, of the folk. Now, so when often, I get a bit twitchy sometimes, really, when people talk about the land. Because I start thinking about, well, what land? When we talk about the land speaking, well, what do we mean by that? I'm happy, really, when we talk about the earth speaking. But when we talk about the land, well, then we inevitably have to look at the question of, well, what land do we mean? What are the borders of this land? And what happens to people outside the borders of this land? Now, it's a personal view, and it's a personal political view. I feel that Britain has benefited immensely from immigration. We have this multicultural, multiracial society that has developed a creativity well out of proportion to its size. In part because it was the hub of a great empire, but also then has received all the creativity of the people who wanted to come and live here and make a life here.
Yesterday, a Welshman told me that Harry Potter and Tolkien stole all their ideas from Welsh mythology. So.
Wow.
Well, it's interesting. Tolkien was deliberately trying
not to do that. To not do that. Actually, now that's actually fascinating to me.
Rob. He stole a lot of stuff from Nordic tales, didn't he?
It's silly when we use words like stole, because actually he's writing from. He's not stealing anything. He's creating his own ideas from other people. You know, we take the material of the ancestors, the writers before us, and we weave them into new forms.
Stolen rather than inspired.
Well, stolen. So that's the interesting note. But actually, what's startling about that encounter you've had, Rob, is that idea. You can hear that kind of, and speaking as a Welshman, as a Welshman, that kind of sense of resentment. You hear that resentment, that kind of, well, this is ours.
Yeah.
They come, they take the mythology as well. It was actually, there were certainly some Welsh influences on Tolkien, but much more, as you say, Saxon influences and Nordic influences, much stronger in Tolkien's writings.
It seems that the past is alive.
Yeah.
Parts of the past, if whatever, are alive.
Yeah.
And wanting our attention.
Yes.
And they grab us.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. And how we pick that up is the important thing. So we can pick this up and be very conscious about it and work with it kind of creatively. Or we can get sucked into some of the shadow territories around this. You know, and clearly, you know, if we think of what happened in Nazi Germany, where, you know, obviously unbelievably appalling. And then, but what do you have to do if you go back a few generations before that? Germany is one of the most creative, modern, rational, multicultural, liberal, interested in Buddhism, in different religions, different traditions. You know, it's the Germany of Goethe. When I was a kid growing up, if you wanted to be a scientist, you had to learn German, because German was was one of the languages in which a lot of scientific texts were written. And this extraordinarily kind of modern culture goes into wholesale, into enormous regression. into the, you know, and we get something like Jung having dreams about the old Germanic war god Wotan riding across the earth, and kind of and Jung is interesting, really, because in the First World War, when he was actually fighting in the First World War, he had dreams about Siegfried, who is the classic German hero, kind of being wounded by the spear of the gods, and a great tide of blood flowing from him, and which of course is what happened to all the youth, German and British and French and whoever else was involved. But his particular images that he gets around the Second World War is this waking up of this ancient tribal god figure that will defend its own and destroy everything else. And in a way, that's always the double-edgedness of working with these traditions, is that we can bring them into a new light, a new consciousness, a new set of possibilities. Or we can get sucked into a performative recreation of an imagined past.
Yeah.
As a resentful and defensive exercise, really. That's the great danger somewhere.
What keeps coming to me is, it's fine us here talking about it and in other similar type groups, but there's so much else. How does it get spread into the world? And also the other thing that keeps coming, having just been to the Van Gogh immersion,
yeah,
and seeing the children there, you know, lying on the floor with the Van Gogh's paintings, you know, going all over them. There's something about how do we make this accessible and take it out into the world? Because How else are we going to change by just talking about it in little groups?
Well, I actually think talking about little groups is really important because it's as we individually embody these things and take our portion of that out into our own worlds, which is, of course, what happens as we do that. It's like a cellular process where one thing leads to another thing leads to another. This is where the quantum mechanics also helps, that idea of spooky action at a distance. So as we understand things, as we embody things, as we meditate and pray and do rituals together, we affect the whole. And so what we do, I think, here and in the other such places, is not a small thing. We will never know the actual effect of it, because the actual effect of it is spread through the invisible and invisible visible connections that we have. But it's the, you know, and one of the interesting things, you come across somebody like Fiona MacLeod, or you come across the Mabinogi writers, you know, they're just doing their thing at their time. They don't know that anything of theirs is ever going to survive, but they're doing it because it's important at the time to do this. Mm.
And that is, of course, with Van Gogh, because
Van Gogh didn't think he was doing anything at all.
And here he is.
Yeah, I mean, Van Gogh's a very good example of that, right? Because Van Gogh, if you like, when Van Gogh dies, his life apparently has been a failure. Mm. You know, his work is not appreciated, not wanted. You know, he didn't know he was going to become one of the great artists of the world. Certainly didn't know there were going to be immersive experiences made about him, you know, and which, you, like you, we've enjoyed, you know. So that's the mystery, really, of the individual human life, where we do not know the extent of our influence.
I had a wonderful illustration at lunch today. I went into the cafe, get a table for myself.
Yeah.
And this very demanding woman is there, is talking to another table. Said, "Do you mind if I sit here?" And I said, "I'm afraid I do. I want some privacy. I want like some private space. Thank you."
Yeah. Oh, well done.
That's me, unpopular in the cafe, isn't it? So she sort of rather glowered at me and walked off. And the table next to me said, "Oh, thanks so much for saying that. You obviously saved us." And then other people were coming into the cafe, they were telling this guy here saved us. She's a really known figure.
Isn't that lovely?
I was the hero of the cafe.
Hero of the cafe. So isn't that lovely? That's so lovely, isn't it?
It ripples out.
No, it does, you see, and that's the whole point. That apparently, you know, that brave but difficult gesture, okay, again has this really good effect, similarly.
I think in that short human span, we get very, very frustrated because there is a tide in the affairs of man, and we can all see what's happening in the tide at the moment, and we feel that we don't want to go along with that tide. But the fact is, you know, tides change. There is ebb and flow, and we might be dead when the tide changes. I always think of that Cook, Elizabeth, someone,
David.
You know, who revolutionised, you know, lovely David. Cooking, and lived through convenience food, frozen crap, all that sort of thing. But she lived long enough to see healthy eating come back. And, you know, maybe we'll be lucky enough to see the turning of this tide, you know, the right, the far right, and all that sort of thing. You know, but there's no quick way of doing it. There's no way of an individual to do it. We just have to observe the times and our place in them, I think.
Yeah.
It makes me think, sounds strange, but it makes me think you can see it in a shorter distance in what happened with blue tits pecking milk bottles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Before the war, blue tits learned how to peck tops of milk bottles to get the cream. And then Second World War happened. And there were no deliveries for 6 years. And all the blue tits died out. You know, they died of old age. And then, so they lost it. But then when the war ended and the milk bottles came back, the blue tits went straight back to pecking them.
Yeah.
Like there was something unseen underneath entangled. It's entangled. Mm. And you know, there's something, and there's probably something in us similarly, but on a much greater than a human lifespan, perhaps, you know, entanglement with things that it will come back, but these things are unseen, and they'll rise again. Mm-hmm. Like you said, the tide.
What you're talking about there is really important, Bill, because it's that holding of a morphogenic field, isn't it? That's beyond our immediate consciousness, and yet it's not just that we're observing or witnessing what's evolving, we're co-creating.
Yes, we are, completely.
In that place of, like, are we consumed by those old energies, or do we co-create with them into something else?
Into something else.
How do we do that? We can only do that through the vibration that we are emanating. So if we were just talking about this, well, then potentially that's the end of it, and we're not particularly co-creative, but talking, thinking, meditating, processing, bringing up the important questions, landing them differently.
And when we can, creating.
All of that gives us the potential to create differently.
It feeds the creative possibilities.
I've got a burning question I've had for ages and I haven't got in. The four worlds that Fiona McLeod talked about that were in the meditation, can you tell us what they are at some point?
Oh, the four cities, you mean?
Cities.
Yes.
Okay. I've been meaning to ask it for ages.
Okay.
I hope too. I thought you were thinking about the fiery hope when you questioned that. We only just asked, does it really matter? And then we had this thing about fiery hope.
The night with the fiery hope.
Was it the fiery hope?
In the
she cards,
the night
with the fire. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. This is my belief, what is being expressed here. but the other part of it is, if you see the news or you hear medicine, some frontier is having to deal with, and it just feels too much.
Absolutely.
And so personally, it's good for me to be reminded again. It's okay, just stay.
I think one of the key things is probably something that Prune has just said. I'm going to come back to the four cities in just a second, but that sense of resonance and embodied processing. So we're not just talking, it's not just a cognitive exercise. We are processing these things through our bodies, through our incarnate experience, and we're entering into a field of resonance and creation. And if we think of Well, I suppose if we think of Gaza for a moment, you know, which... Now, I'm, as you know, I've worked a lot in Israel, worked in Israel for 20 years. And so I have a lot of knowledge of that situation, a lot of experience of people in that situation. And the... And I do know that working in that territory is very, very difficult because of the polarization, because of the fear, because of the pain, the generational difficulties that exist there that are now much worse than in the day. You know, it's been about 7 years or something since I last worked there, and you know, the situation has got much worse since then. But what I do know also is that individual human beings can make a difference, for good or ill. Right? You know, that's the thing. That's the power, and that is genuinely the power of being a human being. The ideas that we manifest through us, the thinking and the feeling and the imagining that happens through us affects the world. And if I think, for example, of one of the there's an extraordinary thing that happens in Israel and across the world now, of the Women in Black. Do you people know about the Women in Black? It's a protest movement where it's very powerful, where women will, around anything to do with oppression, conflict, murder, governmental murder, will stand. They won't do anything. They will dress in black, and they stand in front of governmental buildings or places where things are being made that are about war, and they will just stand as the kind of as living witnesses in grief and rage and mourning, as a challenge to the energy that produces that. Now, that came out of a small group of people. It's a movement that's spread all over the world. Now, that it's a powerful thing. No, yes, it hasn't solved all the problems in the world. But it's something that has influence, has power, does affect people. You know, and I think the problem, the great danger, and it is sort of the danger of the media, really, is that we can very easily feel our individual acts have no significance at all. Mm-hmm. And now that is a particular problem of the modern day, and it's partly a function of being able to think globally. Now, when we were just living in very small places and hardly ever saw anybody else, you knew very well that your individual life had a powerful effect upon others. You know, because if I think of the village I grew up in and the intergenerational feuds and the way these get picked up and carried, you bloody well know that either the people have a choice just to make peace with each other or to create war with each other. And so that sense of feeling crushed by the larger world doesn't happen in the same way, because your world is smaller. Now, one of the challenges that we have in this living, and I would not want to return to that world, is too small a world, to a world that doesn't have enough breadth in it. But one of the challenges that we're in this much wider world is that, well, how do we function? How do we understand that our individual actions have effect? Now, all kinds of things can help with that. But certainly, our experience of synchronicity, our experience of entering into resonance, and our letting ourselves notice co-creation is one of the most powerful things. As we notice what happens, as we put out an intention, as we follow that intention, as we work with that intention, and then we actually will see, if we let ourselves follow that, change. And it happens in small ways, in big ways, but that gives us a confidence sense to keep trusting that sense of resonance, that sense of the, if you like, the spirit coming into matter through us and through our particular form and our particular potentials.
Oh, what about all those marches I went on about the Iraq war? Didn't change anything
No, well, it didn't stop. It didn't stop war, did it?
No, it didn't.
Right, but it, no, but we can't think in those terms, Andy, because actually, you know, it's the effect of whatever you did in those days, whatever I did in those days, will have manifested in all kinds of mysterious kind of ways. And the problem of the thought of it didn't do anything at all. Well, if you just look at what happens to you when you think that thought, now that's the important thing. What happens when we allow those thoughts to, we entertain those thoughts, we allow them to live inside us? What is the effect?
It shrinks us.
Powerlessness. It disempowers us. It makes us withdraw and retreat and
feel hopeless.
And it creates a collapse, as opposed to okay. So what I did didn't stop anything, like, as far as I know. However, it changed my awareness, it changed my consciousness, it informs my awareness now. It maybe informs the awareness of some others. We hold it just slightly differently, and then we start to connect, and then if we start to connect into something larger, something that enables us to operate in a slightly wider space. Now this is why we need the help then of these archetypal structures and ideas and practices that remind us of a bigger world and a bigger sense of possibility in the sense of being the human being. So when we get somebody like Fiona MacLeod looking at the cities of the four great cities of the Shi, what he's doing, and what we get in the beginning of this, the beginning of the immortal hour, when we're given this image, so if we like, we start off with this image of this shadowy kind of figure and this image of a great abyss, and if we think for a moment of that great abyss as the, just for the today's purposes, the abyss between understanding the difference between hopelessness and hope, between collapse and agency. So if we think of that being the abyss for now, and we have this kind of shadowy figure emerging who shows us, first of all, who starts off by talking about, in a rather depressed way, about endless, I've wandered for endless time and gone on and on and nothing I can do, right? More or less, apologies to Delua. And then we have this voice that says, you have wandered around a little space that is a rood, a cross and a circle. So we're given, first of all, this image. So when we're in this place, okay, what's going to help us bridge this abyss between the ideal and the actual? Where he's leaning on a tree, he's reminded of this. So here is a tree, here is a cross, here is a shape. And then as he looks into that shape, that cross, that shape, then he's shown the images of the gods, and told he is a brother of the immortal gods. So to be told that you are a brother or sister of the immortal gods is to say you have some part to play in all of this. And then the sense of looking into this changing world. Right, so they're from the kind of, if you like, that place of nothing works, suddenly the sense of chariot wheels and this sense of things moving and changing, and then I start to see the world that is inhabited by energies of creativity and destruction that are arising and passing away, and then I start to step into that world. And one of the particular kind of features of that world that we find coming up in Fiona MacLeod's work time and time again is this image, which comes out of the circled cross image of the four holy treasures, the treasure, and this comes out of Irish myth, but also you find it in Welsh myth as well. You find the and the Grail, the later Grail stories. You find these holy objects. You find this the sword that divides and liberates. You find the spear that is a spear of will and intention, the spear of light. You find the cup that represents the energies of fluidity and flowing and love. You find the stone that is the stone of, that is the stone of sovereignty and substance. So Gorgias, which is the city of the east, is the place of the sword. So it is a place of newness. It's that place that divides the old day from the new day. The place of therefore the place of death and beginning, the death of the night that opens us into the new morning. We have the spear that is the spear of sovereignty, that is the, if you like, the spear that the king holds at its intention. It's like the upright standing stone in the middle of the day. In the mystery of light and sort of a light shining right straight down upon us.
Where's that?
That's in the south, Finneas. F-I-N-I-A-S. Finneas. We come round to the west, which is the place of the cup, or the cup, also the cauldron, which he also describes as the place of the hollow, the place of water, the place of reflection, and the place of love, the place of the containment, the place of the containment of the heart, the place of flow, the place of irrigation.
Which is?
Murias. This is Murias, M-U-R-I-A-S. And then finally we come around to the place of the north, which is Phalias, F-A-L-I-A-S, which is the place of the stone, the place of matter, the place of substance, the place of the law, the place where the patterns are written in the, if you like, in the principles of the universe. We talk about law as the orderly nature of the universe.
Sorry, which city is that?
This is Phalias, F-A-L-I-A-S. Now, all together, you put them all together, and you have the sense of the human being who holds these different kind of qualities, who stands at the center, who is able to continually create division or breaking the chains of the old and enabling the new, who stands upright in the place of sovereignty, who holds and receives the activities of life in the body and in the heart, and who stands and works with the energies of the universe, the energies of the stone, the energies of matter, and the patterns written in matter, who works with the patterns written in stone. And who, in a sense, is the fifth principle? Who is that principle, really? That balances the other energies and enables something new to come into being.
Is that kind of like the Adam Kadmon?
Yeah.
Archetypal human being.
Yeah.
Is that Savuvial also?
Hmm?
Is that Savuvial like?
Well, Savuvial is the energy of weaving and connection, right? So Savuvial has this sense of, it's like the cord of the circle, really, connecting all the different bits together. So Savuvial is the sort of weaver. Then the human being then stands in the middle, is at the confluence of up and down, east and west, north and south. And then works with whatever direction and in whatever way, and steps into whatever direction, whatever energy is needed. Who really, is, in a sense, is, so sometimes is working in the west, so sometimes is working in the east and working with division. Sometimes is holding and looking deeply into the stone and working and is withdrawn and contemplative. Here is fiery and kind of and bringing about new possibilities, new energies. Here is being the holder and the container, receiving.
So that's the fifth principle, the human being that holds that.
Yeah, well, the fifth principle is the principle of the spirit, but the human being, if you like, incorporates all of these things. Okay, so when we do things like the Kabbalistic cross, we're igniting the different sides of ourselves. When we do the circulation of the light, we're bringing all of these things together into the kind of human form. And then what the intention there is to help us understand the way the subtle energies work with our actual sense of who we think we are and how we think the world is, and then increasingly open through that sense of resonance and co-creation into a much bigger understanding of our place in the world.
And that's where the force sits of the tarot come from?
Sorry?
That's where the force sits of the...
Yes. So that's exactly. So another thing is, so again, you get these repeated patterns happening. So you get these images of a sword so these are very old Celtic images, but they get picked up. So one of the things that happens when the tower in the sort of 16th century, when the tower gets created in Italy, it's even more interesting than that, because they get picked up first of all in Turkey, in Ottoman Turkey. Because the swords and cups and rods and coins come out originally from Ottoman playing cards. But they're coded into the kind of, if you like, the collective consciousness. And then in Italy, somebody puts that together. So who we don't know puts that together with these powerful archetypal images of the journey of the fool, and creates the, and which because the, if you like the journey of the fool and the tarot trumps represent that kind of fifth principle. And if we think of the 22 tarot trumps as a journey on its own, you start off with the innocent fool who goes through all kinds of experiences and eventually becomes this extraordinary figure embracing the world. And it represents, you know, so but of course is working in that journey, is working with these different energies, these different combinations of kind of chalices and swords and sort of in you know, as they play out.
So those cities come from Fiona MacLeod's writing?
Yes, but before that they come from Irish tradition. Right? So he takes them, so he takes the idea of the four cities, specifically out of the Scots-Irish tradition, but before that, out of Irish tradition, from the book of the Annals of the Four Masters, that talk about that. So he gets the idea of it from there, but he writes about it in his own way, in his own particular way.
In the Second Battle of Moytura, which is like an old Irish, Baird specifically talks about. Those same names.
Yes, exactly.
Ancient Irish.
And
tarot.
That is connected with the Sidhe and the.
Yeah, because the Tuatha De Danann supposedly came in the Second Battle of Moytura. His tale. They come from the north.
Yeah.
From these cities, and then they come to Ireland, and then they fight the Sovereign, the Third Bot. They're part of this sort of ongoing battle for Ireland.
Yeah.
Who comes?
The Tuatha De Danann, the children of Danu, who's like the earth goddess. But this whole thing of these, I think it says in it that they studied the occult and sorcery and science, and they were like these. And then when they got to Ireland, they burned their boats, burned all their ships. So it looked like they were coming out of the mist, they were coming out of the smoke of their own burned ships. But there was this real, I mean, who knows when these were first written. It's just ancient, but it's like medieval written down.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've written down a medieval.
Most associated with Sidhe in Ireland.
When the Milesians come, associated like from Spain, they came and they set the Tuatha De Danann into the hills.
The
Hollow Hills.
Then they become the people of the Hollow Hills, that's right, yeah, completely. So this is part of a, you know, so he's writing out of a long tradition, but he's doing what Vadlagiola Morgana goes with Welsh tradition, we looked at it last time. He is recreating something. So he's taking those traditions and writing about them in a new way.
And Elidor is a modern children's retelling of that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Elidor.
E-L-I-D-O-R.
So that's a book by Alan Garner. And that's a whole other thing in itself. You see, Alan Garner writes a novel that's in sort of post-war Manchester, where these kids discover an entrance into the other world, and they discover these objects that actually are the same four hallows we've been talking about, but the spear looks like a sort of an iron railing, you like the spear point, sharp point on the end. The stone is a brick, or half a brick, I think. The cup is a slightly cracked china cup, and the sword is like a kid's sword with two laths nailed together. And I'll perhaps talk about Elidor. There's an amazing bit in that book where he talks about the power of the imagination. You see, because he talks about the doorway into the other world being reinforced or opened by the imagination, and you see the struggle to close and open the door very kind of powerfully in that.
It's a really useful book because it talks not only of the dangers of the mixing of the dimensional realities, but also the reciprocity, you know.
Yeah.
Because at a time when we think it's our worldview that humans are just rapacious, you know, it is we are of value to the other worlds as they are of value to us.
Yeah.
That reciprocity is a really nice thing to remember.
Yeah. Well, again, it's that work of resonance and recreation and reflection. Now, that is the same thing that we find, really, if we look at the four branches of the Mabinogi, if we remember the first branch we looked at, where we look at the reciprocity between the world of Poich and the world of Arawn. And that's, again, in different language, different in a different story, they're telling exactly the same story. They're looking at the reciprocity between the inner world and the outer world. And taking, in this case, in the Mabinogi, they're taking up the old stories but the point, so the question about these things always is, well, what is the point of these things? Mm. What is so in a certain sense, if you think of the first branch of the Mabinogi, it's about the nature of sovereignty itself. And interestingly, it's focused in the south of Wales. So it's focused in the direction of the south. So this whole process around Poich and sovereignty, and his marriage to Rhiannon, and his eventual but partial ability to listen to Rhiannon, is that the sovereignty of the parent king is connected to his ability to mirror the otherworldly dynamic and to be at the service of the otherworldly queen. And so this is the sense, really, of the one who wields the spear, the archetypal masculine energy, is at the service of the goddess, and whose task it is to wield that spear, that rod, that intention, as an act of resonance and reflection, so that the worlds work well together. Now, the second branch of the Mabinogi that goes to the west. The second branch of the Mabinogi, which is the story of Bran, focuses us into the West and into the relationship with Ireland. But Ireland here is the other world, and here we're in because the West is to do with love, but also to do with transition. And it's to do really with the mystery of real transformation, and therefore the incorporation of the coming together of the principles of love and death, even love and hate. Because the big problem that you have in the second branch is that Evanescence, and there's a great play on word here, Evanescence, who is the good person, Evanescence, who is the bad person. So we get they're playing with opposites. And we have this figure of Bran, who's like this great world axis. Again, this great sovereign kind of figure. But we have this, who is the great raven, and who represents really the, and his sister, who is the great lady of the island, and who, what we see happening in this story, and what we're being shown in this story, is that the great thing about the four branches is they really look at the shadow side of these archetypes, is the inability to fully incorporate at the place of the marriage all the elements creates a split that eventually can only be healed by the deeply entering into death, and the Brahm giving himself as an act of love and devotion into the healing of the great split. So he lays himself down so that the crossing can happen. The Evanescence has to be invited in fully, really, into the passage of events, and to bring in the principle of death fully into the narrative, so that the false cauldron can be destroyed, which in itself destroys the malice of Evanescence as well. So it's energy where death and the working with death and the working with the energies of destruction is an aspect of love, which then leads ultimately to the feast of the noble head, which is the gathering together around the source of generation, which is this very ancient communion, which is also in a certain sense the Last Supper of Christ, which then, so there we're given the mysteries of the cup, the mysteries of the chalice, the mystery of the letting the chalice not pass from me in Christ's words, the mystery of the destruct, the death that brings us into life. Now the third branch of the Mabinogi is orientated towards the east, because they go out of Wales, they're heading into Lloegr, and you see a whole kind of errors from the past. So what happens in the third branch is the things that have happened in the first branch that have caused injury come back to haunt the people of Dyved, by this great mist falling down and all the people vanishing. And also Pryderi and Rhiannon also vanish. So we're left with Manawydan, and we're left with Cigfa, who are this archetypal man and woman, the older man, the younger woman, who are not partnered, who are not going to be in romantic relationship with each other, and therefore are not complete, not balanced, but are looking in, but you see a whole process happening before the vanishing of the other two. We have the four of them, Manawydan and Rhiannon, we have Cigfa and Pryderi, that form, if you like, a kind of a balanced unit, going into the east and learning new arts, new practices, new ideas, and then you get the vanishing of half of the couple, and then the return of Manawydan and Cigfa to the mound of Arbeth, which is the mound of the center point, where he plants the new wheat, where he brings the new life into being, and this new life is attacked by these energies from the past in the thousands of mice, and then he grabs the queen mouse, who is the sort of, if you like, the kind of the generator of all these energies that are kind of destroying the new life. And then because of his discernment and ability to see through, we've got again this clarity of the sword, where he keeps seeing through, he keeps cutting through. and he brings that energy of the sword, because he's going to hang the mouse on the mound, Arbeth, and then these figures, disguised figures, come to challenge him, to suggest that he's doing something ridiculous. He keeps on seeing through until eventually the old curse, the ancestral curse, is lifted and freedom happens and everything is restored. So here we see the work of the sword. The fourth branch, which is situated in the north, but also going down to the south, is a recapitulation of all the rest of the three branches in a new story that has everything to do with understand. And this is really the mechanics of this. We think of the stone as incorporating all the understanding, all the kind of the myths of the land, but if you like, the underneath dynamics of the land. So the whole story that we have followed so far is retold in a kind of, in a subtler and summarized kind of way, which shows us all the patterns at work. So we are shown, in a certain sense, the new energy, the new life that manifests from Gwydion. We're shown this figure of Clai. Now, Clai's name in Welsh comes from the word Olai, meaning light. So we see this son of light who is brought up in a particular way and who undergoes the experience of death and resurrection. And in that process, there's a whole process of disturbance, of the disturbance between maleness and femaleness, of rape and restitution, and of the understanding the difference between Anyan and Ferf, understanding the difference between essence and form, which is so much part of the mystery of the stone, of understanding what is underneath, what are the dynamics that are underneath the apparent form of things. And in this last story, all the other dynamics come into play, the sense of sovereignty, the ability to see through delusion, but above all, where it comes to an end is this quality of yearning and love, where at the great tree, that the great oak, the presence of Clai, the being of light, the child of light, is brought down into incarnation, into the arms of Gwydion, now the man-woman Gwydion, who through his act of yearning and love, and then brings about a new age, a new set of possibilities. So you can sort of see really what the writer of the four branches of the Mabinogi is up to. He's doing something very, very similar to what Fiona MacLeod is doing, but he's using the particular Welsh myths in order to do that.